This is bonkers.
This is amazing. We're in Chesterfield, and there's snow outside, which is a thing that I've gotten unused to seeing at this point in the year in New England.
Yeah.
The winter.
Well, right? We're with Claire Marneau of CISA, the bi-local folks, and who are you?
I'm Rachel Robertson-Goldberg of Crabapple Farm.
And I'm Tevis Robertson-Goldberg, also of Crabapple Farm.
And we are at Crabapple Farm, not outside in the snow, but inside in a greenhouse that is ridiculously lush. But I think we're mostly looking at houseplants and herbs, is that correct?
Yeah, this end of the house is the half that we keep heated through the winter with the wood stove. The far end is sort of the cold side, and so that we keep stocked with sort of cold hardy herbs that we sell through the winter. And then in the spring, of course, the house changes almost completely to tomatoes and peppers and other garden starts, though we still have the house plants pretty much year round.
I was just looking it up. 2020 is when we built this structure. We call it the fish house, which we haven't walked quite far enough in to see why we call it that. But when you have a bunch of these plastic hoop structures, they all sort of look alike, and you've got to come up with some way of distinguishing them by name. Or when you say, you know, meet me at the hoop structure, then nobody knows where you are.
You could be at any
of them. We have these masonry wood stoves that Tevis built to keep them warm through the winter. In the first winter or two, we weren't confident that we could keep it from freezing in here. We figured it wouldn't get very cold, but we weren't confident we'd be able to keep it from freezing. And now, as we've gained confidence, our collection has expanded.
Rachel, what do you grow here at Crabapple Farm?
All sorts of things. Our business has gone in myriad directions as our interest draws us there. Most of what we produce is vegetables, which we sell at farmers markets here in Northampton and Pittsfield through the main season and also through the winter. We raise sheep, we have a laying flock of hens, we have cattle, and we do a lot of houseplants as well, or also indoor plants, you know, herbs that could go in the garden but also do well as houseplants. So that's what's closest to the door, because that's what we're going to be bringing to winter markets, so we're sort of organizing to facilitate that.
Bringing a little bit of green in for the dark days ahead.
We talked to you last December, I think, at the Tuesday market, because the state had announced at that time that HIP, which is the Healthy Incentives Program, which is an instant rebate program when people use SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, to buy produce from participating local farms. So last year, the state cut HIP benefits. Mm-hmm. Temporarily, they are now fully restored to their typical amount, which is up to $80 per household, depending on family size. We were talking to you back then about how a program like that benefits your farm, enables you to sell to a much broader population of people. I'm curious how things have gone in the past year on that front with all of the SNAP pause and everything that's happened recently. Just curious how that's landed for you all as farmers.
Yeah, so it's definitely had an impact on our business. I think out here, there's a lot of folks who have gardens, and they really value the security of having a garden. So it was really hard this spring for a lot of folks who use that HIP benefit to be able to boost their garden plant purchases so they can get their gardens planted. For us, every time it's come up, every time anyone asks, we say that May is really important for the HIP benefit, to have that extra boost each month to what folks can buy, because the HIP is not just for food that you can eat immediately, but food plants that you can grow to eat all season long. So we definitely saw a reduction in how many garden plants we were able to grow, how many herbs and vegetables, and folks were struggling and definitely stressed about it. It was difficult to have that. And this is something we've seen through the years of having the HIP benefit since it was initiated. It's really such a wonderful program. But they kind of keep jerking the chain on whether we have it or not. It's destabilizing to have something that you can rely on, except not really.
But it was really beneficial at farmers markets having the HIP program being fully functional, this fall when the federal government was not fully functional because, you know, both of the markets that we sell at have doubling programs that is reliant on local private donations where the market is able to double people's SNAP benefit in addition to the HIP benefit. And so those two non-federally funded aspects meant that people were still coming out to farmers markets because they were getting benefits to help them with food.
Yeah, it was one of the things I saw passed around a lot when the lack of SNAP funds was right. coming out as news, is that if, at least in Massachusetts, because of the HIP program, if you kept at least a buck on your SNAP card, you'd still have access to your HIP dollars.
And a lot of folks are getting less than $40 a month
from
the federal government for their SNAP benefit. And so having that $40 is really huge for a lot of folks. That's something we've seen over the years, but also especially this, you know, these past couple of months.
And you were one of the stops for McGovern's farm tour this year?
Yeah.
And SNAP is one of his major issues because hunger is one of his major issues. What was it like talking with somebody who really did understand kind of the import of those programs for farmers, which people don't necessarily see all of the time? Like, it's important for the people who are getting the food, but it's important for the people who are growing the food also.
Yeah, it was really great having the opportunity to talk to Jim and his staffers and other state folks came out to also tour farms because it is, you know, it is really important for us to know that we have an elected representative who puts in the effort to talk to farms directly, figure out what is important to them, what's working, what isn't.
It was really gratifying talking to him, hearing him listen and hear what I was saying. Those two groups, the folks who are beneficiaries of the SNAP program and farmers, are often brought up as the main and primary and maybe exclusive beneficiaries of this program. What I have seen is that they are really just one piece and they're maybe a keystone, but those programs are really helping the entire community.
We've seen a good handful of like super diversified farms that are doing a lot of things, but not a lot of them bringing houseplants and herbs to market in the winter. Mm-hmm. Like we'll see winter crops, we'll see like other things, but not necessarily something that you can take and grow yourself.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that to sustaining your farm in the winter?
So, you know, the plant sales through the winter, it's not a huge amount of our sales, but it definitely is a nice piece. It's nice to have them at market. As you said earlier, it adds a little bit of green at a time of the year when people really crave that. You know, so we do a few different types of plants. We have culinary herbs that do well as just windowsill herbs. And, you know, the way I, you know, culinary herbs don't make great houseplants. They tend to not last forever once they're, you know, sitting on a windowsill in a pot. But they last a lot longer than a bunch of fresh herbs. And a lot of people, you know, really only want a little tiny bit of rosemary or a little tiny bit of sage at a time. And so a bunch of herbs, you know, you can dry it, but people are worried about, you know, I don't know if I'm going to use all of this. Whereas a plant, you just can pick off a couple of leaves to throw it in supper. And that's really nice. And so we've found that it's really nice to be able to have that. I don't know. It's a nice thing to have. It is adds a little bit of diversity. Every grocery store I've been in has a plant department, but not every farmer's market does. So we decided that we would be the plant department at, you know, the markets we do. We find that one of the most popular requests for a houseplant is a plant that I can't kill. You know, so the two ways that people tend to kill plants is neglect or overwatering. And so the succulents are great for those who are prone to neglect. And then we have other options for those who are prone to giving plants too much love.
We've sort of specialized in plants that are difficult to kill because the number of different things that we're doing, it's hard for us to focus on providing plants all of their idiosyncratic needs. And so we don't do the true tropicals in here.
This house is warmer than outside, but it doesn't stay warm enough for a lot of the true tropicals that are very popular in the nursery trade because they do great in a completely climate-controlled, very warm greenhouse. Often. But they tend to not do well in people's windowsills at home. But they look great.
For like a month.
Yeah.
talking to everybody who bought a Croughton out there and then was heavily disappointed shortly after. Talk about shearing and spinning, because I noticed that Rachel has a hat on that is definitely made from yarn from your farm. Do I say this because I have bought yarn from your farm? Maybe. Was it the best present I gave my knitting mom? Also, yes. But yeah, talk about the yarn component of your farm as well, because you do make really beautiful, really nice to handle yarn.
Thank you. Yeah, this is a grass-fed hat that I'm wearing. One of the magical things about sheep is an interest of mine from my youth. I was excited about yarn and enamored of this concept that sheep can grow this wonderful fiber that we can turn into our own clothing. And so we focused on having our flock produce fabulous wool that's soft and durable and warm and enjoyable to work with. We hire in somebody to come and do the shearing for us. That happens once a year.
He's local. He lives in Cummington.
We get the sheep all corralled in into a snug pen so that it's easy to grab them, which is actually less stressful for them. If they can't run away, then they don't feel the need to try. And so they just one at a time, they go through, they get sheared. He's pretty quick, maybe like 5 minutes a sheep or so.
Oh, he is quick.
Yeah, he trained in New Zealand, and he does a bunch of large flocks in New York State. He sort of jokes each year that ours is the timing of it is before he heads out to do these big flocks in New York, and we're his warm-up.
our 50 sheep he does in a morning, about 3 hours.
Largely due to the systems, to make sure that he always has another sheep.
It takes about six of us to keep up with him. To keep the sheep moving, the wool moving, so that he is just shearing sheep the whole time.
Get the extra debris removed, and then it gets rolled up and bagged up and labeled, sorted by color, to be sent off to be spun.
We're at Crabapple Farm in Chesterfield with Rachel and Tevis and Claire Morneau of the My Local Food People CISA.
Yeah. Rachel, I've heard you talk about your kind of philosophy, or maybe your shared philosophy around raising animals for meat, mm-hmm. and the sort of thread of connection to human history. I remember you talking about how you think about, as a farmer, raising animals knowing that they are going to be killed to be eaten, and the sides of that can be kind of hard for people. And yeah, I'm just curious if you want to share anything about that.
Yeah, you know, so it's something that's really important to us that animals are living well. My husband and I each went through a stage of being vegetarians, largely because of the horrendous conditions that animals are raised in for food in this country, or really for any purpose in this country. When you are raising a large number of animals without care for their individual selves, I don't think it's right to be doing that. And so we didn't want to be a part of that system, so we stopped eating meat, which I think a lot of folks go through that logical path and make those choices for themselves. The more I looked at farming, because for me, I'm really drawn to animals. I didn't grow up at a farm. I grew up in a suburb of Boston, but my mom grew up on a farm without indoor plumbing, really, till she was 10 years old. But her folks had a big garden that they ate from. It just seemed so natural to raise food for oneself, this connection with these animals that have been living with humans for thousands of years. Cattle, sheep, goats, chickens, dogs, and cats have been living in community with humans for thousands of years. And I would say we each exist because the other exists. Without these food animals and companion animals, people wouldn't be what we are today. And that, to me, it's a strong bond. And to me, it feels a sacred bond that we as a species with these other creatures as species. And I feel this way about the plants that we produce, our food plants, as well as the animals that we live with. It's easy to see a framing where the people or the farmer or the shepherd is in control of the situation and is in some way dominating these other species. But we feel that our lives are really defined by the lives of these creatures, particularly if you have a dairy animal.
You are a servant to the milking schedule.
And our lives are built around basically serving these animals' needs and meeting their needs. We define our seasons by what are the needs of these animals and cutting the hay so that we have it to feed them through the winter. Our winter schedule is bound by their food needs. And so it is something that we take really seriously, that commitment that's a shared commitment, that their entrusting us with their lives, and we are reliant on them as well.
We've gone a long way round, but Rachel mentioned that she didn't grow up on a farm. Tempest, did you grow up on a farm? How did you come to farming?
I did not grow up on a farm. I grew up in the Mid-Hudson Valley in New York State. My parents were sort of homesteader, back to the land types, but not super serious about that. So I did grow up with a garden and some, you know, chickens, some livestock. I sort of came to farming out of environmentalism in sort of high school and college, realizing that agriculture is the largest impact on the environment that people have. Basically, I came to farming wanting to farm in a way that I would feel good about and wasn't compounding all of the issues of modern society.
I think it's interesting, you know, you started out this conversation talking about Hip and Snap and the way that your farm is part of the, I mean, we talk about this at CESA all the time, the ways that local farmers are allies in the fight against hunger, and that is a way, you know, the harnessing the food production potential and the markets that local farmers are at as a resource for low-income people to access food. You know, it's one little piece of this really complicated puzzle which makes up our food access situation in this country where way too many people don't have enough food. But it's also interesting to think about farming as a way that an individual family or an individual person, or as a non-farmer but as a consumer, we can make choices that are in alignment with our values. We can be sort of making choices that do have an impact in our own communities and in our own local environment that really do matter. So it's interesting to be hearing about you coming to farming from an environmental background, and we've been talking about how your farm has become a place that helps to feed your community. Can think about it as kind of a holistic approach to thinking about the world's really big, complicated problems.
The ecosystem is there, as tenuous as the threads continue to be frayed, but it's all important so that we all can be fed and everybody can thrive.
Maybe we can ask just about the winter markets, which are starting up. We've talked about the house plants and some of the other products you have, but I think that people continue to be surprised when they go to winter markets by just how much is available locally throughout the winter. Can you talk about the range of things you bring, what else people can expect to find?
Yeah, so we bring a lot of root vegetables. We, you know, we haven't quite finished, but we're getting close to the end of harvesting things out of the open fields. We have a lot of potatoes, carrots, turnips, winter radishes, beets, things like that. We do a little bit of greens production, cold hardy things like kale and spinach, but we mostly leave those crops to the bigger farms in the valleys with more space under plastic and just couple degrees warmer nighttime temperatures than us.
And more staff.
Speaking of, am I looking at the staff of Crab Apple Farm?
We are the staff, yeah. It's the two of us. And so there's a lot of things that we do that, or I guess a lot of things that we don't do because we don't want to do those things. Going out to harvest icy, snowy kale in the wintertime is...
That sounds terrible.
It's not alluring. It's not alluring. And so we are happy to make do with radishes and carrots instead of and go a little lighter on the leafy greens because, yeah, we don't have to keep harvesting those through the winter. And that's really what those crops through history, that's what those crops have been for people. They're crops that sunlight while the sun is shining through the main growing season, and then bring those crops in and access them from the shelter of your root cellar or your walk-in cooler, as the case may be. And they stay fresh all winter long. I know some people are a little wigged out when we say, you know, in March that these potatoes were harvested in November, and they're a little taken aback, like, oh, I thought farmer's market is for fresh food. Like, well, it is still fresh food, but we just didn't harvest it this morning, you know, from under the frozen ground. But this is their dormant phase. What they're doing in our walk-in cooler is the same thing they would be doing if they were out in the field.
And it's a good lesson for folks that you can store things much longer than you think you can if it's done properly.
Yeah.
And in proper places.
Yeah, I should say I've tried, meaning like I have kept vegetables around for a long time and discovered that I did not have good conditions for them. But, you know, the farms that are at winter markets do. So you are able to keep crops ready to go in a way that like I can't do at home. But that is what one of the things that's so great about having markets that run all winter long, which is still feels relatively recent to me. Yeah. You know, 15 years ago, this was a brand new idea, and now we have winter markets all over the valley. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, you know, part of that is because of the HIP program that Massachusetts has put out, because we have the confidence that there are going to be people who are going to come out and buy those produce all year round. And so it's worth growing it and storing a big pile of it. And so that's, you know, yet another way that everyone benefits from this program. For myself personally, I think it would be really awesome for Massachusetts to be secure in its in food production. And I feel like we could grow enough food within Massachusetts to feed the people who are here within Massachusetts. It feels like this HIP program, I don't know if that was the intention behind it, but it feels like it could be used that way to help make that possible, to pave the way for Massachusetts to provide for its own needs, at least its basic needs.
Along those lines, like the loss of HIP last year, even though it was reinstated, that severe reduction was a big blow in general, and farmers plan way, way, way in advance. Did last year's loss affect the way that you're buying seeds for this coming year?
For us, you know, we are a small operation, just us. We went through a period where we were a larger farm. We had 3 employees. We were doing, you know, 3 farmers markets a week and a CSA and a farm stand. And it really just didn't work out for us. But when we sort of go back to thinking about expanding production, the uncertainty of the government programs is what makes the difference in our viability. And, you know, it's happened a couple times now that they've just sort of disappeared for a while. It makes it really hard to consider hiring employees in order to expand production. Just talking to other farmers who have a lot more employees, last winter was a lot more stressful for them than it was for us, because they had to meet payroll even though their sales were not where they had expected them to be. You know, the downside to these programs is if they just sort of come and go based on political whims, it's really hard for farmers to plan based on it and to trust that, you know, if your business is really dependent on that, you know, what do you do if it disappears?
Why is this one the fish hoop?
Yes. The fish house?
The fish house.
This is the fish house. We'll take a little walk down there.
Yeah.
When we first built this structure, I think I mentioned earlier, we weren't confident that we'd be able to keep it from freezing. We also weren't confident that we would know if it did freeze or not. And then after the sun comes out, we come out to check, we wouldn't necessarily know that the ground had frosted. But we would know if there was a big bucket of water in here, if there was ice still on that water, then that would be a visual that we could check. So we happened to have what we call a shampoo bottle, which was a gift from my uncle, 550-gallon shampoo bottle. But it did, I think, at one time hold a natural shampoo. It's been cleaned out. So we filled up this 500-gallon tank with water and added in something that I have always wanted, which was a goldfish pond into the center of this house. So goldfish are able to survive in very cold weather. They're cold water fish. And so we dug it in about 1.5 feet into the ground, and it stands up above the ground the rest of the way. At the center of this house, there is a goldfish pond. So this is the fish house.
Also, it serves as a thermal mass heat storage part. This house has like 4 or 5 different passive methods of storing heat, in addition to the masonry wood stoves. Because no one thing by itself was going to prevent it from freezing in here. When I was designing the system, I knew that if I sort of stacked different systems on top of each other, each thing adding a little bit more heat buffer, hopefully it would add up to it not freezing. Turns out it worked.
Cool. So we can go visit the fish if you'd like.
Yes, please. Oh, wow! Those are great and gorgeous.
Gosh. So this biggest one here, this is Goldie. She is our longest lived resident. We had her in a 10-gallon tank in our house. She's at least 10 years old. She might be 14 or 15 years old.
That's old for pets regardless of type.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, is this what you had dreamed?
Close enough.
Yo, check it.